remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know who, what, where, when, why. We having fun, yeah. Why It Ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon. We're acquaintances. I know who you are, and I'm feeling pretty good today because I love talking to Santino Marella last week, and I think we're on a kind of a roll because if you want to talk about our first ballot people that we wanted on Why It Ended, when we first started talking about this, one of those people was Santino Marella, and another one was today's guest.
I know I'm going to get a lot of heat for this, but I'm going to have to backtrack. What is a ballot?
Oh, so like... You know, when you get in the Hall of Fame, you know, you can write down, you vote on a ballot. You vote on that. So it's what you, do you vote?
I don't believe in voting.
Like you don't believe it exists or you don't believe in doing it?
I don't believe in it because presidents and all those people don't affect my life. So I don't want to make the wrong, and I know nothing about it, so I don't want to make the wrong decision. So I don't want to vote for the wrong person because I know nothing. But also, it doesn't matter which dude wins. It's not going to affect like my Robbie E. world. You get what I'm saying? And I've told numerous people this. Actually, Bruce Pritchard knows my whole,
I've heard about this.
Story. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. But anyway, that's for another day.
You know, I had a talk with Bruce once about you, and I said, is Robbie E. for real? And he goes, 100%, man.
Anyway, so back to our guest. Forget I ever asked about the ballet or the ballot. Our guest today
the
is
ballet.
A guy that I actually was a fan of when I was in middle school because he got to walk to the ring with Jacqueline and Terry Runnels, who I was like, oh my God, he's walking with these beautiful women. We meet Stasiak's son, Sean Stasiak.
Hey, check this out, guys. This is a great interview, as is Santino. But there are people, friends of ours, and we've started our Patreon. It's starting small. It's going to get bigger and bigger. But they've already heard this interview. They've already given us feedback. They already love it. So check it out on whyitended.com, or excuse me, patreon.com/whyitended. And you can hear these interviews early. As soon as we finish, we get them up there. And we know people are hungry for our interviews, and you can check it out. And you can do so at a pretty low level. So go ahead and sign up for Patreon today, and you can get these interviews early. And also, check out our YouTube at whereitended.com. And also, what else we got going on, Robbie? I've lost my mind.
Well, you can follow us at Why It Ended on Twitter and Instagram. And then, of course, Pro Wrestling Tees, get our shirts. And I think... we're about to get down and dirty with another great interview because I definitely want to talk to Stasiak about about the whole tape recorder incident, which led to his first firing from WWE.
And we will probably do that on Why It Ended.
Hey, dude, come on. That ain't fair.
You see, I started slow and then okay. Sean Stasiak.
On Why It Ended.
Hey guys, we know we have a lot of male listeners, and for those guys, do you remember the days that you were always ready to go?
Well, now you can increase your performance and get that extra confidence in bed. So listen up, it's bluechew.com, and guys, that is blue like the color blue.
It's a crazy thing, it's a chewable, and it's available from bluechew.com. And it's got the same FDA-approved active ingredients that you find in Viagra and Cialis. You know they work. And like I said, it's an easy-to-take chewable.
Yeah, you can take it anytime. You can take it a day. You can take it at night. full stomach, and since they're chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill, so you can be ready whenever an opportunity arises. Because let me just tell you something, an opportunity could arise at any time.
Well, for almost everybody except me, but let me tell you this, if it did, if in fact it
That's
did,
true.
You know, all I gotta do is go online, because Blue Chew is prescribed online, and it ships right to the door in a discreet package. You know, so there's no like in-person doctor visit. You don't have to be embarrassed or have that awkwardness waiting in the pharmacy. And it's a much easier way to kind of be always ready on the go.
And we all know, Matt, that you probably have had that awkward waiting in the pharmacy visit before. But nonetheless, Blue Chews are made in the USA. And since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they are cheaper than a pharmacy, which works out really good for your pocket.
You know, and it's... Guys, this is a no-brainer. You know, if you've always kind of considered something, you know, to help you in this way, you know, Blue Chew is the way to go. You go to bluechew.com and get your first shipment. Guess how much it is, Robbie?
How much is it,
Matt? It is free. It is free when you use our special promo code, Robbie. All you got to do is pay a measly $5 shipping for a free shipment of Blue Chew.
And that special promo code Robbie, R-O-B-B-I-E. And notice how they made the code after my name and not Matt's.
Well, they actually want people to buy it. And don't, and don't just take our word for it. I know many people who have used it and they love the Blue Chew. Again, that's Blue Chew, BLUE Chew.com. Promo code Robbie to try it free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice. And man, we appreciate them sponsoring the podcast and being supporters of Why It Ended. And make sure to go to bluechew.com. What's the promo code again?
R-O-B-B-I-E, Robbie.
It's amazing. He has to spell out his own name. Try it today. Bluechew.com, promo code Robbie.
I'm a college graduate.
All right. So guys, joining us today is someone you might remember, of course, from Attitude Era or WCW. It is Sean Stasiak, otherwise known as Meat Sean, or Dr. Stasiak, as I should say. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, man, no worries. I know we played a little hiccups to try and get the proper day down to get this going, but I'm glad you're here. You're a perfect guest for our show. And just diving right into it, bro, I mean, listen, you grew up as the son of a wrestling legend. What is that like when you're in grade school, knowing that your dad was a wrestling star?
Well, you know, I have the earliest memories of my dad when I lived in Connecticut, when my dad was working, I believe at the time would have been for Vince McMahon that we know of today, his father, Vince Sr. And I just remember, you know, some vague memories there. I just remember being in Madison Square Gardens and seeing my dad. I couldn't understand. I was too young. I don't know why my parents had me at a wrestling event, but at that age, but maybe they couldn't find a babysitter that night. But I just remember, you know, 20,000 people yelling at my dad. They were angry at him. My dad was bleeding, and I think he was wrestling Bruno Sammartino or Pedro Morales or one of those guys back in that era. And my dad, of course, was one of the biggest heels at the time, you know, during that era. And so I remember that. That's probably why I've been traumatized from day one. but you know, I had my memorable times of my father would be growing up on the Pacific Northwest in Portland, Oregon, because back in my dad's time, of course, there was New York, the Eastern Seaboard, which it was, you know, WWF territory, as you guys, or WWE today, but as you know, New York territory, they had different territories, like 30 different, you know, territories around the country. And Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest was a huge hotbed for professional wrestling. Don Owens was the promoter out there. And my dad was a huge hit there. Of course, my mom's side of the family was from Portland too. So I grew up there. I spent a lot of significant times there and childhood memories. And so I grew up around what's called the Portland Sports Arena back in the mid to late 70s into the early 80s into the mid 80s. And I ran into guys, people that we know, such as The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, Rocky Johnson would come through the territory. And that's when I met Dwayne when I was, I think I might've been 8 and he was 6 and a half. So I'm a little older than him. But you know, I saw the likes of Harley Race coming through the territory. Andre the Giant would come once a year. you know, Ric Flair, the locals there. Roddy Piper came through Portland Wrestling. Playboy Buddy Rose, Killer Tim Brooks. These are names that maybe you guys have just heard of vaguely or haven't heard at all, but those were the names, and that was the experience I grew up around. Of course, my dad would take me, you know, I'd go to the Portland Wrestling on Saturday night. It'd be a TV show, a TV taping for a couple hours on KPTV Channel 12, and it would come on, I think, at 10 o'clock and then at midnight. And the next day, they'd go to these local towns. It could have been 300-400 miles away. And he'd take me on the road with him for some of the smaller shots, you know, like within a couple hundred miles. But it was oftentimes that I'd be in his beloved camper. He loved that camper. And we would travel from town to town, kind of like that movie Every Which Way But Loose. He kind of just went from one night. You know, Clint Eastwood's in this fight with this biker gang, and then he's going on to the next town. And it's kind of like what I experienced with my dad. We go fishing all day at camping grounds, and you know, we'd hike out and camp out, and then that night at the local town he'd wrestle, and then we'd go pack up and go to the next town. So I had those kind of memories with my father.
Dude, that's freaking awesome.
Yeah, and he was a big name, you know, in Portland too. Everywhere we went, and people recognized him, of course. So I was exposed to that whole notoriety thing. We couldn't go to a grocery store, a movie theater, or a restaurant without him getting, you know, bogged down with taking pictures and conversing. Conversation.
Now, at this time, did you dream about being a wrestler watching all this go down? Like, was it something you knew you wanted to do?
You know, back then, I think there were moments where I thought that's what I was supposed to do, but it never really hit me until actually later in high school when I really decided that I wanted to take after my dad, and that it had enough of an influence on me that, you know, maybe I should give this a shot myself. So it really wasn't when I was younger. I think I just relished in the, you know, the experiences that I was witnessing with my dad, and he was my hero, and I looked up to him literally and figuratively. And, you know, and so that was just kind of that realm. I don't think it really dawned on me, you know, really. It was, I remember when I said to myself, and I called my best friend at the time when I lived outside of Toronto, Canada, where it's a home away from home for me. And of course, I lived all over the place, guys. I mean, people would say, where are you from? Well, I was born in Hayward, California. And, you know, I was just born there. We moved around everywhere. And people would say, well, you're a military brat? I'm like, no, I'm a son of a circus, professional wrestling. We traveled to so many different territories. So that's why I moved around so much. I was yanked in and out of school districts my whole life. High school, I went to three different high schools my freshman year. But where I'm going with all this is that it was in Toronto, or outside of Toronto, a town called Oakville, Ontario, outside of Toronto, that I was watching a Mr. Perfect match, and I called my buddy because we're all trying to decide what we're going to do when we graduate from high school. Are we going to college? Are we going to go just right into the work world? What are we going to do? And so I was gearing up for a wrestling scholarship to go to you know, college, university. And so were all my buddies. And my buddy on the phone that night was a football player, got a football scholarship. And I said, you know, I know what I'm going to do, though. I was so inspired by Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig. And I had met Kurt earlier in my life when he was only 18 or 19 years old. I must have been 8 or 9 years old in Portland, because he came through there at the territory as well. And I remember saying, I'm going to be a professional wrestler. I'm going to definitely give it a shot, because I was inspired by Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect, guys like Ultimate Warrior, Rick Rude, you know, the guys with the better physiques and bodies. I guess, you know, I was around a bunch of athletes, and during the off season, we lived in the gym in the summer. So we just kind of took on that fitness bodybuilding lifestyle. And so that's kind of when I felt that I've got to give this a shot. But that didn't come later until even after college for me. I went to Boise State University. Actually, I went to a junior college in Kansas for a year, Colby Junior College. Believe it or not, Daniel Cormier, the current UFC light heavyweight and heavyweight champion, went to Colby. So I'm glad I wasn't the only one. But anyway, I went to Colby for 1 year. And the whole idea was, and the reason why I went there to such a small no-name school is because I graduated high school in Canada. So there wasn't a lot of recruiting, like people to help you out to try to get you scholarships to the States at the time, you know, for a wrestling scholarship. It was mainly focused on football. And I was the only wrestler in the gang of guys that I hung out with. They're all football players. So they're all, you know, got football scholarships. So I don't want to point fingers, but I didn't really have the proper counsel or direction or advice, you know, to go to play the game. Or I should have had recruits watching me and looking at me my junior and senior year in high school wrestling, which I excelled at. You know, I was a 3-time provincial champion in Ontario. And I was I played second and third in the Canadian National Championship. So I had a pretty successful, you know, amateur wrestling career in my high school years. But I really had no choice but to go to a junior college. And I said, well, the whole idea was the coach there, the head coach, Steve Lampe at the time, he went to Iowa State, and he had a pretty good relationship with Dan Gable for Iowa and Iowa State. And so he said, if you have a good year, he goes, I could probably get you transferred and get you there, you know, to one of those schools right away. I had a good year, 17-4 on the season, but I honestly just choked in the regionals, man, and I didn't even qualify for nationals that year, which is ridiculous, but that's a whole different story. But the point is that I went back home to Toronto and tuck my tail between my legs, and then I ended up going to Eastern Michigan for a month. That didn't work out. Went back to Toronto and got a factory job at Xerox Color Toner Plant, Oakville. A 22-year-old kid getting during a time of recession. I think I still made at that time was pretty good money. I think I made around 50 grand that year. But I was living in a factory and I just got so down on myself. Like, what am I doing in my life? I got to get back to school and get this another shot. So I marketed myself and sent out a bunch of pictures of myself and just showing the shape that I was in and just like a little resume showing my credentials in wrestling. And I got picked up by Boise State. I needed a heavyweight. I needed a place to call home, and it worked out. I became their starting heavyweight for 3 years. And I was a 2-time Pac-10 runner-up, and I was a 2-time NCAA tournament qualifier. I placed, I think, top 12 my last year, misplaced and by an All-American by literally 1 second in double overtime. So it was a successful career, but hindsight is 2020, you know, until this very day at 48 years young. I think that's what drives me to still push myself in the gym and stay physically fit and stay in that competitive mindset and that competitive mode, because and I think that's what happens to us guys in life. You know, a lot of times we ask, why did I fall short? Why did things not work out in the context of what I always anticipated or what people were saying or what the, you know what I mean? Like, you had all these tools and everything, even with my professional wrestling career. I think that's what drives me today. There's a fire deep down in my soul that even though I've, you know, become a chiropractor and a speaker and in my community, it's fulfilling and liberating, but there's still a piece of me that just, there's that burning desire, that fire that's still there. And you ask yourself, when is it time to quit? Like, you know, and for me, I don't think I'll ever quit. I think I'll always have it till the day I die, because that's what keeps me driven and keeps me wanting to make up for maybe what I might have felt that I fell short of in those contexts, if that makes sense, guys.
Yeah, no, it totally does. So all that, you get back into wrestling. How does that lead you back? Well, how does that lead you to originally getting into pro wrestling and to eventually be trained by Dory Funk Jr.?
Yeah, so I was at Boise State, and I finished my amateur wrestling career. We were Division I Pac-10 conference at the time, of course, I was watching pro wrestling, like, you know, every time, any chance I could, and that was during the time, I believe, with WCW and WWE, the Monday Night Raw and Nitro Wars were going on. It was around, I think, 95, 96, I started really honing in, and there was no wrestling schools in Boise. The closest school would have been in Portland, Oregon, which is about a 6-7 hour drive away. And it's funny how my career got started, because it's a couple moving parts here, but I didn't really get formally trained professionally in Portland, but I went out there the summer of 96, and there was a local promotion, and you know, I just finished my wrestling career, you know, at Boise State, and I was in shape, and I'd watched it for so many years. And of course, I think we all did this. We're all fans and marks deep down, but you know, I've goofed around with my friends, and I don't know how many clothesline clotheslines we took in that college apartment, busted furniture, doing stupid spots. We had no idea what we were doing, but we were just emulating what we saw on TV. So I think, in essence, my dad was actually surprised. He said, "Sean, is this the first time you've been in a wrestling ring?" I said, "Well, yeah, I guess it is." He was like, "How did you learn to do all that stuff?" You know, I was already selling, not very good at it, but I still had some basic mechanics down and an idea of what I had seen, you know, on TV. And just being an athlete, I think it just came natural to me. But, yeah, I was just, I had 10 informally trained pro wrestling matches on a local TV show. They stuck me with a guy named Brian Cox, Bruiser Brian Cox, who actually passed away years ago, God rest his soul, but kind of got me started, got my feet wet, you know. But then I went back to school that following semester to finish my degree. My actual athletic career was over. But at that point, I was just really focused in on, what do I need to do now to maybe pursue this pro wrestling career? Because I'm already like 26, 27. I'm getting up there now. You know, I got to a later start. And especially for a guy who came from, you know, the family lineage that I have, right? So it's kind of funny because I mentioned earlier that I was inspired by some of the better physiques and the theatrics. So I was a big fan of Ultimate Warrior, Sting, of course, you know, the Road Warriors. I like the theatrics. I like the color comic books come to life type of feel. And so I'm a big kid till this very day. I'm a Halloween freak. And I got tired of playing other wrestling roles. Like one, you know, Halloween, I was a pudgy, ravishing Rick Rude, you know. Then the next year I'm Ultimate Warrior. You know, in college I have baby fat on me, but I'm still trying to, I'm wearing the robe and I got this wig and mustache on and try to emulate Rick Rude. Then the next Halloween I'm Ultimate Warrior, you know. And I finally just got sick of doing, you know, emulate other characters. So, you know, this year I want to be my own character. What could I do theatrically that would be my own character? And it's ironic because if you go to I have a website, it's called phobiatv.com. it's F-O-B-I-A TV.com, and it's actually going to be reconstructed soon, same as SeanStasiak.com. Those are my two character identities that I play, you know, those two roles. But Phobia, that character name came about when I had, okay, so just a real quick story. This is all tying into me getting my tryout with WWE and how this all came to happen. So for a couple Halloweens, in the local community in Boise, of course, I had a name from being there starting heavyweights. I got a lot of news coverage in the town, right? And I had made a, you know, created a good rapport with the sports team. And so I, anyway, that's, it was, I think it was the spring of, I think 95, I think it was 96. I can't remember exactly. It was back in the mid 90s. And I was just finishing up my degree at Boise State. And, you know, it was exam time and I didn't have any air conditioning in the dorms and we just had fans on and the windows kept them open, right, to get some breeze. And for a couple of weeks there, I would feel this, like, I don't know, like a debris or something on my face in the middle of the night. And I would kind of wake up and you know, slap my face and kind of itch, you know. And I thought maybe it was just some kind of debris floating around from my fan blowing, you know, in the room. And then I noticed that I started breaking out with these stress bumps, and of course I was stressed out from exams and lack of sleep, and it was just a stress, you know, exam time is always stressful. And so finally I just feel nauseated and just kind of sick, you know, for a couple of weeks. I finally just went to the local, like a health clinic for the students, right? Went in there and take a look at me, drew some blood, did a little cotton swab deal. And the guy, the doctor comes back to me and says, he goes, "Sean, those aren't stress bumps. Those are spider bites." I'm like, "What?" So I'm putting two and two together, and I go back to my college dorm room and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, those do feel like little, you know, spiders on my, maybe something, you know, like it felt like it could be insects or something on my face." So I go back to my room. I'm ripping my dormitory room apart, you know, and look into the closet, drawers, I'm looking everywhere. I finally ripped my bed out from the wall, and lo and behold, underneath my bed was a spider nest. And it's a true story, man. I was basically being bitten by spiders for 2 weeks. So that explains the bumps and the nausea and just, you know, and that debris feeling I had at night. So later that, a few months later, when it was Halloween, I just said, I need something to design and paint my face that would cover my whole face like Warrior or Sting would do, right? And I just formulated 8 legs on my face as a spider, and the one word I muttered under my breath was, you know, I know arachnophobia means fear of spiders, but it was just the one word named phobia. And you know, so I became this character phobia, and I got on Channel 7 News to do these PSAs for kids, safe trick-or-treating, don't talk to strangers, stay accompanied by your parents, that kind of thing. I did that for a couple of years. So I kind of created this little notoriety in my local town with this character phobia. And I thought it was going to be maybe a wrestler idea. And I actually, when my dad passed away, June 19th, 1997, I was actually at my dad's funeral, and of all people, Matt Bourne, Doink the Clown, who played Doink the Clown, he, because he was friends with my dad, and then my dad worked with his father, tough Tony Bourne, back in the day. And he said, Sean, he goes, I know it's a tough time, but, you know, WWE Raw just did a montage of your dad, and, you know, timing's everything, especially in this business, and I know it's a tough time, but you might want to go ahead and send that tape to them now. And we're talking VHS tape, guys, how long ago that was, almost 20 years ago.
And so you sent the tape. You sent the tape with the vignettes of phobia to the WWE. And who was the first person who called you after you sent them?
Yeah. Well, God, I'm trying to remember. I think it was Bruce Prichard, because Bruce Prichard was head of talent relations at the time, and they bid on it. They said, "Wait, we watched your tape." You know, basically the tape was just the phobia character talking on the local news channel. So it showed, you know, theatrics, and I would get myself in great shape. I lived with a couple bodybuilders who kind of helped me learn techniques of taking my physique to the next level and nutrition and all that kind of stuff. And so I would, like, that was like my bodybuilding show. I had 2 minutes on the local Channel 7 News. So for 8 weeks out, I would do this diet and extra cardio and all that stuff to try to look as good as I could to make an impression with this character that I envisioned. And so I would do that. I did that for a couple of years, and I sent that tape to them, and they liked it, and they said, "Hey, you know, we really liked your charisma and liked your presence and all that kind of stuff. We saw some of your clips from your wrestling, from NCAA and also those 10, a couple highlights from the pro wrestling matches in Portland, the previous summer." And so it got me a tryout. So phobia in essence, never got picked up as a wrestling character. Hogan liked it when he was at TNA and wanted to bring it in, but that never came to fruition. And then I realized years later, which is now, that I'm so glad that it didn't become another wrestling face-painted wrestling character. To me, and there's no disrespect to pro wrestling, but it's bigger than that. It means more than that to me, because I define the character, and what it meant to me, or what it means to me, is that it's a depiction of all the fears that I've gone through in my life: fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of success. You know, so it's an emotional attachment that I have with the character. I've done anti-bullying campaigns with it, some short theatrical films with it. I've got big visions with it that I'm going to go to the next level with that. But phobia was the precursor that got me my tryout, and that's how that started. I went out there to Stanford. I think it was in September of 97, and the first people I hung out with was Dr. Tom Prichard. It was at the headquarters there in Stanford, in the old studio where the old wrestling ring was, in the warehouse. And Yokozuna was my first chuck I hung out with. And so we hung out with, you know, for a couple of days, and I think he was injured or something, was trying to, you know, come back. So he was just working on things. And this is before, you know, Louisville, and I think they sent guys to Memphis at the time for their TV show to get guys prepped for WWE. But it was just kind of the wild, wild west, man. And I was there, try it out. Had a headache for 3 days.
Well, let me ask you this. Like, it seems funny to me that you had to work so hard to get noticed. I mean, you had a great physique. You created a character. But, you know, your father was a WWF champion at a time where that title did not change hands very often. And we know that the WWE now is crazy about second generation guys. How much cachet did your pedigree have? It seems like it should maybe have gotten you more of an in that it had, and you might not should not have had to work so hard to get in.
You know, when I look back, though, I don't think I really yeah, you would think that. I see what you're saying. But, you know, I didn't really work that hard because here's the thing. I never really got involved too deeply with the independent scene. A lot of it, like when I went to those, when I went to, finally when I had my tryout 2 months later, they called me back. And then I was there in January of 98 and starting the Dory Funk Junior Camps. They're called the Funking Dojos. And we must have bumped 300 times a day. It was almost taking his Japanese experience from the dojos there. And he incorporated this training grounds, you know, in Stanford. So I met the likes of guys like Edge and Christian and Sean Morley, Val Venus, Test, Andrew Martin, Mark Merrow came through there, the Giant Silva, John Tenta, Dan Severn. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Now, when you guys were all there together, were you like getting along well, or was it like, oh man, I want to be better than this guy? Was there a lot of competition?
You know what? I was just so happy to be there. It's a teenage dream for me. And I got along with everybody. I mean, there were some guys that I think, you know, I think it's just natural. It's an alpha male, you know, testosterone filled type of, egoic, you know, world, you know, fictitious world. And when I say fictitious, I'm not demeaning it. I'm just saying it's a pretend fictitious world. And there's a lot of egos, and you know that, guys. I mean, you know, you know this full well. So there's that. I think it's healthy to have some of that. And I think there were certain guys that I felt that maybe would be my competition, and it was fine. It was actually healthy but we still supported each other. Everyone got along. I think at that point, all those guys I mentioned, either they were trying to work their way back into the lineup, or they were just trying to get a contract. They're trying to, you know, come aboard full time. And these guys have been working for 3-4 even longer years than I had. I was the greenest, rookiest guy there. I was there because of my athleticism, my physique, my presence, and my name just got me my foot in the door. You know, that's all that got me. So to answer your question, you think it would be easier? Yes and no, because I was kind of disengaged from pro wrestling because where I lived and I, you know, I finished my college career a little bit later and I got to a later start. So I'm grateful that I got the opportunity when I got it. It didn't come that hard. I mean, I did have to, you know, after my first tryout, I did call and bug them almost every other day until they said, come on out. We're going to put you up in a developmental and get you trained and get you where, you know, we think you have what it takes to be, you know, a top guy here or to get you going with us. So that was awesome, you know. But, you know, to answer that question, though, when you fast forward though through my career, I I'm not pointing fingers and I don't want to sound bitter. But the reality is, you know, it's a very political game. And for me, I don't think I dealt with my dad's death right. I think I actually ended up putting so much pressure on myself that I became a little insecure or neurotic and I didn't want to fuck up. You know, and when you worry too much about messing up and you worry about it so much, well, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to mess up. So I just, you know, I think I labeled myself. I know I did. And I think there's a stigma that came with my name. And because it's a shark eat shark world, and a lot of the guys you get to the WWE at that level during that time, during the embryonic stages of the Attitude Era, which was a very special and unique time for professional wrestling. You know, I was in with, so here's a guy that comes in with a great look and has a name but you know, wore his heart on his sleeve and never had any wrongful intent, but it got used against him, because maybe that person's a threat, you know, maybe they're worried that this person comes along, develops quick, you know, you just never know. And you guys probably know this. I had some glimpses and moments. And I think a lot of fans over the years have said, God, we thought you were coming up but they just never really gave you the ball. I never really had that love and support from the office that I guess looking back, I you know, could have used, because even though I was a grown ass man, I was 28 years old, 29 years old, but you know what? My dad had passed. I'd been disconnected from that pro wrestling. I just watched it. I didn't have a Pat Patterson or a Jim Ross or an Arn Anderson or somebody that was kind of, you know, how some of these wrestlers, and I'm not taking nothing away from anybody like Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, Steve Austin, none of these guys, but a lot of those guys had people in the office to kind of overlook things a little bit. It would have been nice to be pulled aside and say, Sean, you know, you need to do, and I think Tom Pritchard did his best with me at the time to help me with that. You know, I don't want to take nothing away from Tom. And again, I'm not pointing fingers, but I'm just saying, looking back, look, it's the power of the pen. You know, I could have been a multi WWE champion if they really wanted to put that strap on me. You know, I wasn't the greatest wrestler technically, but look, all you need is a good punch and a kick and give me and a little bit, you know, bump and sell. Give me the microphone, either piss people off or make them love me, one of the two. And my point is that you get people emotionally invested. No one gives a shit about a match if you don't care. So especially back then, I mean, I appreciate a great wrestling match. Don't get me wrong. I mean, seeing guys like Finn Balor, the Eddie Guerreros of the world, and Shawn Michaels and Bret Harts, and I had such an appreciation for a good technical wrestling match that tells a good story, the psychology and playing with people's emotions. That's what that's about. It's a modern day Shakespeare. But, you know, there's also been a lot of guys with far less talent that had looks and could talk and could get people emotionally invested in them. And they made a lot of money, right? And that's what it's about. It's about putting asses in seats and getting ratings and subscriptions, especially in our day and age today with social media and this WB network. So at the end of the day, yeah, and I made, and there was a couple things that didn't help my career. I'm sure that you guys have heard of, like, and I bring it up myself now because I realize it's always synonymous with my name, but that tape recorder incident, that was stupid. It was just a bad joke. It was a rib that went wrong place, wrong time. And everybody jumped on the bandwagon, got in Vince's ear. And guess what? I got fired. That's what happened. It's okay. That simple.
As the story goes, you were recording an argument between Davey Boy Smith and Steve Blackman. They didn't know it. You did it as a rib, according to what you've said in the past. But you say that it was a rib, and you're also saying that people around the incident used it as an excuse to pile on and bandwagon and get this young new threat out of the company.
You know, I don't have all the, you'll never know. You'll drive yourself insane trying to figure out what the real reasons of anything is in that business. But if you're not on the end, right, in the office, but so it wasn't really even a real argument. It was just more of those two guys. It was a long road trip. We're in Quebec. Everything's in French. These guys are, they're always working out, and it's always about, you have to eat every 2 hours. So they're always, you know, they get irritable. I get irritable. I mean, it's just one of those things where it was just kind of funny that they were kind of bickering a little bit. And I was just, recording them without them knowing, because I was going to play it back for them and say, this is what you guys sounded like for the last couple of days. You sound like a couple, bitches arguing back and forth about, you know, just playing a joke. Now, I look back at that and realize, and if you guys would have known me, if they would have known me from high school, as a little kid, my dad bought me my first tape recorder. I used to, impersonate characters or actors, or, you know, even said that when you're on the road and you're on long road trips, bring a tape recorder and work on your craft, work on your promos. That's all that was. So I just, where I went wrong is and look, I'm being who I am today and what I know about the business. And, I didn't have a long career, but I would consider myself a veteran type now, because I've been, I broke into business back in 96, officially, and I still do the odd promotion from time to time. So I guess I'm considered a veteran myself, in the sense that if a young rook came in and was recording, if I thought that they were remotely had a recorder in a locker room, and the word was he was recording a conversation in a car without their, without them knowing it, and then it just blew out of proportion. I mean, I would be hesitant too. I pissed me off. I understand that. I mean,
was it Davey Boy that got pissed off? Was it him, or was it both of them?
I don't know. I think it was probably both. And I think the boys too, when they found out, I think that they piled up on it and kind of magnified it, and it made it bigger than what it was. And it took on its own life, and they created it into something that was much more of a monster than it ever remotely was in reality. You follow me?
Sure.
And so that's what happened, man. And so if I was trying to be sneaky with something, if I was up to something, like, the word was, well, maybe he's working for Hard Copy, or maybe he's working for WCW, and it's a paranoid business, because there's a lot of things that are sacred things that are shared in the locker room. And I get that. And I respect that. But it was a stupid thing to do. I mean, looking back, it was ridiculous. It's stupid, right? I mean, who does that, right? but me in a very harmless, fun rib that I was going to play back. But I couldn't get to that point because when I was asked if I was recording, just the way that I was approached, I realized, shit, these guys don't know me, and I really don't know them that well. And you know what? That I need to put that thing up and just, you know, and I was going to record over it. There was nothing on there that I had any use for. But if I was so sneaky, why the heck would I have kept that damn recorder in my bag? I think I had it for the following loop. I had it in my same gym bag with a bunch of cassette tapes, you know, because back in the cassette tape day, right, that recorder was there. So if I was being so, why the hell would I have kept it in my bag and left it in a locker room for anybody just to go in? You know what I mean? So my heart, my intent had nothing to do with, but here's the bottom line. At the end of the day, you know, I got fired. I learned a lesson. I went to WCW. I had to prove myself. I ended up having a better year there than ever. I was on TV more. I traveled.
Yeah. Were you expecting that at all to have, like, because I know you said
well,
you
yeah.
there for, you knew
yeah,
you
I was,
there.
I was concerned. I was hoping that wouldn't come because I heard, you know, through the grapevine that day, I think Tom Pritchard came with me and said, you know, why did you do that? I couldn't explain, you know. Why did I do it? It was just a joke. It was just me. It's just me being me. And that's it. I mean, I don't have any other answer than that, you know? And so basically, yeah, I was just, they kept me around for a couple more weeks and I noticed they were just jobbing me out. So I think they were just trying to get their last use of me to feed other guys to build them up and say, okay, we're going to can this guy. And then, you know, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, well, maybe I'm just in the doghouse. I was told, you know, by some of the veterans that did trust me and believe me and said, don't say a word. I wasn't treated, you know, it was some disrespectful, ways I was treated, you know, because of that situation. And I wanted to fight back. I wanted to, you know, but I didn't, but my bigger concern was I didn't want to lose my job. I didn't want to lose my dream, my childhood dream. That was my biggest concern. So I was like, basically just going to have to eat shit for a little while, Sean, and put up with the bullshit and just, you know, just tough
and
it
you
out.
Had every, you had every reason to believe, you had every reason to believe you'd come out the other end, but who came up to you and said, Sean, that mistake was too big. You need to go.
God, I'm trying to think back. You know, and there was guys concerned, like, you know, Mick Foley came up to me and pulled me aside and was concerned. Of course, I was traveling with, you know, Kurt Angle at the time. We did, a lot of people don't know this, but I've had some of my best matches with guys like Chris Jericho and Kurt Angle that were on spot shows or house shows that were non-televised. You know, people never got to see those, but I was traveling with Kurt and Kurt would just say, you know, just keep your cool and don't, you're tough, you mentally, physically, you'll get through it and you'll be okay. And I thought I was going to be okay. They kept me around, you know, for another few weeks. But I think it was Jerry Briscoe, man. I think came up to me. I think it was at TV's and just came up to me and said, hey, you know, Vince wants you to go home. And God, I was devastated, man. I was like, so that's it. And, you know, I was, you know, and of course, I didn't know if that meant just go home now or for good or what, but it seemed like that was it. Like I need, you know, so some of the guys heard about it and they would call me and said, hey, hang in there. We're going to, you know, what can they say? But we'll put a, if we can, we'll put a word in that, you know, how we feel about it, that we know that you didn't mean any harm by it, that kind of thing. Like I believe Christian and Edge and the Hardy Boys and guys like that I, you know, went to the fucking dojo camps with. But I think I don't want to talk disrespectful of the deceased, but I don't know who was really in Vince's ear. I heard rumor that it was Davey Boy because he was, you know, he was the guy, he was a river, you know, and maybe he just felt like, I'm going to teach this guy, this young rook a lesson for doing that. Who, you know, how dare he rib a river? I don't know. But, and God rest his soul, you know, I don't have any hard feelings at all. Steve Blackman's the other guy. Maybe he had something to do with it. I talked to Steve years ago. I had a little bit of a, I'll just keep this to my, between Steve and I, but I had a little bit of a, deep in my heart and my soul, I felt wronged by some things. I felt disrespected. And there was a time in my life where I thought, you know, I don't know. I don't have peace with this. So I'm going to call him up and have a little chat because I just didn't feel good about it, you know? And, I don't know what that was going to lead to. they're almost thinking, man, if we go to Fisticuffs, we should just do our own pay-per-view, and people would probably pitch in $5 to watch that. We make money doing that, you know, regardless of who gets their ass kicked. But anyway, but Steve came across as, you know what, he came from a place of his heart. He was peaceful. I instantly felt relieved. And I was like, you know what, let it go, Sean, let it go. Because that ate me up for a while, man. For years after, it haunted me for a little bit, because it was just so messed up, you know, to lose your WWE dream because of something that you had no wrongful intent whatsoever, you know, and it backfired. And it's a true nightmare come to life, you know? You know, and I don't think, guys, I don't think when I, you know, I won't get into the WCW story yet, but I think ultimately in the long run, I don't think it helped my career. I think that stigma was always there with my name, because there were many other times and opportunities to push me. And to start, I was starting to develop, you know, a couple of characters I came up with that they never got it right. I tried different things and, you know, but when you're getting signs in the audience, you know, a fan has an opportunity of making a sign for anyone on that roster, that show, and they're making a sign for you. Isn't that a sign that you're starting to get over, you know, like run with this thing? But, you know, I learned in that business too, they might have invested in other guys where they're paying a lot of money and they got to get them over, and you're going to get so many guys over at once. So maybe it's like, no matter what you do, if they're not ready for you, you're not getting over. They're going to squash it. They're going to feed you to other guys. And so that's the part of pro wrestling that was hard for me, because I'm a real competitive athlete. I come from that real competitive background. I love pro wrestling. I love the art and philosophy of it and telling a story. But God, it's tough when you don't have. And I'm a team player, man. I mean, I don't mind jobbing out to anybody as long as it makes sense, as long as it keeps me strong and keeps the longevity and the integrity of my character and my brand. I don't care. But just some of the stuff they had me do, looking back, my God, it was just so stupid, you know, and it's a waste of talent, a waste of time. And I'm not trying to put myself over. I'm just, I'll call a spade, and I'll be the first one to say that was the shits, or that sucked, or I need to improve here or there or whatever. But I'm just saying, I just feel like I got a bit of a raw deal in that whole thing, man. No pun intended with the word raw.
And then what eventually from there led you to WCW?
Well, I got fired from the WWE, so WCW was the only viable option.
Well, I mean, did you reach out? Did they reach out?
You know, I don't. Again, I think I reached out to. I don't know how that happened exactly. I think because Vince Russo went over to WCW, and because he had worked with me a little bit with the goofy meat character when they first broke me in WWE. And I think the fact that they were looking for the new blood thing, and I think it was just a good opportunity. I was fresh off WWE TV, not that I was really over or they really did a whole lot with me, but I was, you know, visible and people knew who I was at that point. I'd been in the business for, I think, about a year and a bit at that point now. So I think they saw it.
Why did they send you down to the power plant, though? It was weird to me, even at the time and looking back now. You had been on TV. You had had matches. You had success. You had matches with Kurt Angle, and you showed that you belonged in the ring, but you get signed by WCW, and instead of going straight to Nitro, you went down to train at the power plant.
Yeah, you know what I think it was? I think that you got to realize the small community, and regardless of, you know, what, you know, separate companies, WWE at the time, WCW, I don't know if ECW was still going on at the time, or, you know, my point is, though, it's a small knitted group of the boys, right? And the people behind the scenes in the office. Well, I think the word, I mean, everyone heard about what that tape recorder thing that happened, right? And so I think that there was a testing ground to see if I had an ego to test me out. That whole testing thing, you know, like, oh, I guess I'm being tested again, you know? But my whole point, though, is at the time I was like, whatever it takes, you know, at that, you know, I'm still young. I haven't scratched the surface of my career. You know, I've got some experience under my belt. I've got some TV experience and TV time, and I understand this business now a little bit better. So I was willing to do whatever it took. Send me to the power plant. That was where my Division I wrestling background kicks in, because I was like, bring it on, man. It was tough. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was tough, but you know what? I'm so glad that I had my amateur wrestling experience and all the training and conditioning I went through at that level. It was very, very feasible for me to go through. And so I think I, I stood the ground with those guys. And I think also they wanted to see how I got along with these newer guys, like the Palumbos and O'Hares and the Jindrax, Mike Sanders, some of these guys they were bringing up. Right. And I think they just want to say, hey, you know, we want to build this stable and we've got ideas maybe. And, you know, I told Paul Orndorff down there, I said, Paul, you were one of my favorite heels, one of my favorite wrestlers. I loved his whole persona, man, the robes, the cockiness, the intensity, the bat, everything. The butt. He was awesome, man. He was freaking awesome. They don't make guys like that. They don't make guys like Rick Rude. You know, when Rick Rude walked through the curtain, you know, I believe he could kick my ass and steal my girlfriend. You know what I mean? Now, I don't want to say much. And God bless the guys today. I mean, bless their hearts. And I got some guys I'm pulling for. And I'm trying to just, you know, I'm still a fan deep down. I watch the shows. I want to be inspired. I want to feel like I did when I was a teenager watching wrestling today. But the point is that I said I wanted to be the next Paul Orndorff type of guy in WCW, and I wasn't just telling Paul to blow smoke, but you know, Kevin Sullivan at the time had something to do with I think J.J. Dillon. There was, you know, some like in the office, they liked me. They saw they got nothing but good reports. They said, "Hey, welcome to the team. You're part of our family. We know what happened down there with WWE was BS. It was bogus what happened. You got the, you know, we trust you. You worked your ass off. You've got all these attributes. Let's make some money, kid. Let's do this." And I was, you know, that was it. You know, that's how the WCW career got started.
So there's something I've always wanted to know as a fan. Robbie's a wrestler, but I'm just a fan. And, you know, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, by the way, was my favorite wrestler as a kid. I thought he was amazing. But when you look at the Power Plant versus Dory Funk and Tom Pritchard, it seems like the people who went through the Dory Funk, Tom Pritchard method, a lot of them ended up with a lot of success and long-term success. And even though Orndorff's one of my favorite wrestlers, it seemed like a lot of people that went through the Power Plant did not. And even a person like Goldberg, who had a lot of success, a lot of people criticize him for not really being physically prepared, you know, as far as knowing how to work and not hurting people and that kind of thing. Do you feel the Power Plant was a good training ground and does it compare to Pritchard and Dory Funk Jr.?
It's such an interesting question, and no one's ever asked me that. And I'm just listening to you, and it's like, wow, that's a great question. And I got an answer for that, and based on my own experience. I think the Power Plant was more of almost like an NFL combine. It was to test your physicality. It was to see what kind of will you had. You know what I mean? They made guys quit, man. You know, you heard stories about the Power Plant. And even when I was there, I think it was toned down a bit when I got there. And I think that the fact that I came in as someone who had already been a little established on TV, you know, from WWE, that I got a little bit of a pat, and trust me, they still put me through the gauntlet, man. It wasn't easy. I think that was more of a performance weed out system. And honestly, it might be a little boneheadish. So, but when it comes to psychology, when it comes to timing, delivery, on promos and when to say what and what, you know, what to say and when to say it. And just all the deep psychology, man, you couldn't get it better from Tom Pritchard and Dory Funk Jr., you know? And then all the guys that I was surrounded by up there, those guys were all veterans. Like even, you know, Edge and Christian, guys like that, they'd already been in the business 5-6 years. So they already, I mean, we go to these spot shows and I watch their magical guy. And I used to think to myself deep down, damn, these guys are way more advanced than I am right now. Their psychology, the things they do. It was great to be around because I was exposed to that right away. I caught on pretty quick, you know, and Kurt was green. I was green, but we were real athletes, real wrestlers. And so we had good matches. We had good chemistry. But I think by having Dory Funk around with his old school, you know, his era, but the Japanese style and just his, you know, his psychology. And then Tom, who's a little more speedier and zipped around the ring. But everything, if you watch a Tom Pritchard match, you know, he doesn't get enough credit for what he was. And as far as, like, technically sound, like, just from locking up to hitting the ropes, to hitting turnbuckles, the way he bumps, the way he sells, I mean, he was awesome, you know. And I'll tell you what, like, some of the – I see some – you know, and I don't want to mention names because I'm not here to, you know, point fingers or nothing, but I mean – you know, I see some things in the ring technically that Tom Pritchard would rip my ass if I walked up that way or I, you know, I did something. He was very, tedious on me, very, very adamant about certain just subtle things that made the biggest differences. The way you sold your face, the way you locked up, the way you walked around, you know, all those little subtleties make the biggest differences in how you command a presence and the message you're sending. With WCW, I just felt that was just a, it was just more of a, you know, like a,
it was like how many squats you could do, right?
Yeah, like how long can you last?
Like how many squats and push-ups?
Yeah, right. How long can you last where you puke all over the place, or you know, how long can you go before you drop? And you know, now Paul, he would go over psychology and different things, you know, with us. But I just don't think it was quite constructed like WWE. You know, and that's just that WWE up there, man. That was just years of combined experience. And I'm, again, Paul Orndorff's great, but it was just a bunch of young rooks that were green that just had great. I mean, Sean O'Hare, 6'6", 280, doing, you know, flips and whatever the hell he did. I mean, he was an incredible athlete. Springboards and Jindrak, same way, 6'6", 260. These guys were huge. And Palumbo didn't do so much high flying stuff, but he was very agile, very athletic, moved great for a big man. You know, I was probably the least athletic of those guys, you know, of all of them. But
when they eventually brought all you guys to TV, they started you as natural born drillers because you guys got that big push and you were all, like you just said, fairly new to wrestling. Most of you did. Was that a lot of heat in the locker room? Any problems with the guys?
You know, I'm trying to take my mind back to this, give you the most accurate, authentic, organic answer. It's just been a while. You know, I think that I remember feeling a little bit of tension or that maybe some heat, you know, from some of the veterans that were there. But I also understood that, you know, I was always very, very respectful. And I think that's what Paul Orndorff installed in all of us, is just be very respectful to the veterans, and because you're going to get this push, and don't be assholes about it. You know what I mean? Don't be pricks. Be gentlemen, be professional, be respectful, and rightfully so. And so that's, I personally didn't feel much of that because I was, I grew up around my dad and my particular background. So I just kind of had that innate respect thing going on anyway. I think there was a little bit of that going on. There's some sour faces there, but you know, that's just life. That just happens in any business. But yeah, but I don't think there's a problem.
When you guys got brought up, you know, or when you guys got put together, you know, you got Sean Stasiak, Blue Chipper, Mike Sanders, unbelievable potential. Sean Hare, can't miss prospect. Mark Jindrak, can't miss prospect. You know, Johnny the Bull,
Chuck
and
Palumbo.
Reno, all these guys with all, Chuck Palumbo, all these guys who had all this potential, were they rushed up? Like, should they have learned more? Because when you look at someone like Sean O'Hare or you on paper, it seems like a can't miss thing for a future superstar. Like, even when WWE bought you guys out, it seems like maybe there's more that could have been done to prepare those younger guys.
I don't know. I think that the WCW did the best they could given what they were given. And who knows, maybe it was I'm sure there was some kind of a pressure felt from way up top with the money aspect of the company. Maybe they thought, we got to create new stars. We need a new look to the show. And you know, that happens. Maybe that happens in the NFL or other sporting events. They try to rush, you know, prospects up too soon. They get injured or they choke under pressure or whatever. So that might have been going on there. I think that if you were to take that same stable you just mentioned and you gave them, you know, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 Dory Funk Jr. Funking Dojo camps, and with Tom Pritchard, the same experience that I had, but you know, to really refine some things, I think you would have had those guys were great, man. They were great athletes and they were catching on. But I think that there was and as you guys know, you'd be a great athlete and have a great physique and be agile and mobile and all that stuff. But I find that with so, like, sometimes those moves it's almost like they're big guys trying to show the world, hey, I'm a big guy, I can do flyweight maneuvers. Okay, great. But I don't know, man, like do them to a degree, but if they're done so much and it just takes away. I think psychology is so important. Less is more in a lot of ways. You probably have heard that term. And I just think that there was a certain ring savvy that just was lost somewhere in translation that, well, that just comes with experience. I think they were rushed. And I think that, again, they were doing athletic things that I couldn't do, that I couldn't fathom, or at least was going to try and, you know, break my neck. But I don't know. I think, I think that you can make more money in that business if you have a great look. You got a great punch, great kick. You can sell. Maybe a couple finishing moves, maybe, you know what I mean? And be able to talk on the mic and get people emotionally invested. But the way that you walk around the ring, the way you look at people, the way you glare, there's all those little subtleties. You know, it's just like an actor. You know, they can have all the ability in the world to say a bunch of lines, but if they play a role where they just say a few lines, but when they say it, boy, they deliver it, that goes a lot, goes a lot further, right, than trying to cram a bunch of stuff in and say, hey, look at me, look at what a great athlete I am. I can do all these moves and I'm 280 pounds. I think that they're, I just think that, and that wasn't those guys' fault. I just think that that was just the way the circumstances were and they did the best they could given what they were given.
So you were there about a year, you had a good year. You actually wrestled on the last Nitro. What was the feeling like? Like, when did you know that it was all done? How did everyone react to WWE buying WCW?
You know, I wasn't nervous about it, honestly, because I felt that I had a good enough showing with WCW for a year, and I was coming into my own at that point. They put me in an angle with Bam Bam Bigelow. God rest his soul. He was a great guy to work with. Always kind
of
me.
You had like a tattoo match with him, didn't you, in that time?
Yeah, something like that. Some gimmick match. By loss, I got tattooed, and you know, but the point was that it was the last match of show for Nitro or for WCW for that matter, and I just had this underlying confidence deep down that I just felt that I had come into my own enough and honed in my craft enough and proved also from the year and a half prior with that old tape recorder incident that went down, that I think the proof was in the pudding, that it was bullshit, the whole thing. It was blown out of proportion, and that I went to another company and I improved myself. I improved my look. I think I improved my work. My promo skills could be better, but I mean, I was working on those. I was finally getting more mic time. They were giving me, I was finally feeling the love and support of a company, and it was really nice. You know, that's what I never wanted to work for any other company than WWE. I wanted, when they took me, when I was one of the first 10 contracts that they bought over, I felt like I was back home, man. I really thought, I was like, wow, they're going to, this time it was, you know, a misunderstanding. It was a lesson learned. I paid my dues. I paid the price. I'm back home. Now let's make some fucking money. Let's just do something with this now. You know, let's go somewhere. And you know what? Just never came, man. And I think that
it looked like it would too, because the initial talk was there were going to be separate shows, separate brands. You guys are going to, you know, invade. It was going to be a big deal. But very soon after you guys debuted, they shifted. They switched horses midstream. They lost confidence in WCW. Of course, a lot has to do with our friend Buff and his match with Booker. But what do you ascribe that change in attitude to, where it went, WCW is going to be a big deal, to, oh, we're just an afterthought now?
You know, the thing is that even though I was with the WCW stable, when I came over to WWE, in my heart, I never felt that I was with WCW. I felt that I was still a WWE guy. Isn't that interesting? I never, and plus I knew a lot of the guys backstage from WWE, and I felt that it was, I just feel welcome back.
Was it weird at all? Was anyone weird to you when you got back, like remembering what happened the first time?
You know, I think there was a couple guys that had sour faces a little bit, but you know, after a while it's like, dude, seriously, I mean, come on, man, it's not junior high school. You know what I mean? Like, grow up. But you know, but I also was told by Briscoe at the time, Jerry Briscoe, I think he came out, he said, hey man, you know, we're glad to have you back. Welcome back home. You should never have left in the first place, but everything happens for a reason kind of thing, right? One of those powwow talks in the stands before the doors opened and setting up the ring and everything. And he said, but you know what? Yeah, if I were you, I would go up to a couple of the veterans and just be extra, you know, nice to them and just let, you know, it was one of those kind of like walk around eggshells, kiss ass kind of thing. And I was like, God, are we still doing this, man? Like, I mean, it's like, you know, it's funny. I in the context of pro wrestling, you know, Mike Enos explained this to me years ago. He said that, you know, professional wrestlers are like a bunch of junior high school students with money, or it's like a prison in the back. It's like you got the Undertaker's the main guy walking the yard, and I love Undertaker, by the way. But you got you know, everyone's got their little role back there, and it's like you got to kind of play this role, man, to get, you know, because you got to fit in backstage. You don't fit in backstage, man. You know it's going to be tough for you to last A and B. To focus on your craft and to make money. That's why you're there. You know, you're away from your family. You're traveling thousands of miles. And, you know, they said the miles and the money are real. So are the bumps. But, yeah, man, it was just one of those things where, like, you know, I just played the game. And you know, over time, I'll prove myself here, too. And I just thought that, you know, I wasn't expecting, like, oh, right away things are going to happen. But, you know, even within a year or two that – you know, just do what you got. You know, they're having me running the milk trucks and walls, doing some goofy character stuff. The Planestasia idea was my idea. I'm a big Jim Carrey fan, the actor, and he played the Riddler in Batman, and he's very charismatic and colorful. And it was kind of an idea from that movie, the Riddler. But they made it into a guy out of his mind talking to himself from, thought he was from outer space. You know, that was not the idea. Really, it was, and we just never could get on the same page. Just getting jobbed out from one match to the next, and it was discouraging because you put this time and effort into staying in shape and, you know, working on your craft, and, you know, you go the extra mile and you invest in the new gear and just trying to think of new looks and how you can repackage yourself. And it's like, no matter how you try or what you do, you show up to the arena the next day. You know, and then you see your name on the list, and it's like, oh, we're got to get so-and-so's hand raised. You know, just after a while, it's like, good, you know, what can you do? And you try to, for me, it just, it did seem to click. So, and I even, you know, I've had meetings with Vince. I tried to meet with Vince. I told him about the Planestasia. I went into character right in front of him in Arizona. I remember exactly where I was, in Phoenix, Arizona. When Sergeant Slaughter said, he set it up for me. He said, hey, I get you a meeting with Vince. You can, and Vince said, hey, Vince wants to talk to you about this character. I didn't tell Vince about the character. I went into character in front of him to give him the full, you know, I don't want to talk about the character. Just do the character, you know, cut a promo. That's what I did. He liked it. But, and they started getting over and getting signs, Planestasia signs. And, but they just started jobbing the thing out and just making it into a jackass, you know, and it just, fizzled away and died. And then they finally, you know, I got the phone call from Johnny Laurinaitis. I think it was September of 2002. And he said, and I thought that I was going to be going to SmackDown or something. Because he's like, John, he's like, I got some bad news for you. I thought he was ribbing me. I said, I already know, John, I'm going to SmackDown. Yeah. He goes, no, we're giving you a release. I'm like, what? You know? So anyway, and then I said, well, fuck this, man. I'm done with this. I'm going to go become a chiropractor now because, you know, I'm just done with this business. I mean, it's like either you're in or you're not. Like, and if you're not, you're screwed. You just can't. You have the greatest physique. You have all these skills. You could have all the potential. You could have a name. You could have all these things, right? But I'm case in point that if you're not over with the powers to be, and you got the people in Vince McMahon's ear or whoever's the powers to be's ear, that's not on your side. You're screwed, man. There's nothing. You got to go make your own destiny somewhere else.
Well, let me ask you this. And of course, you know, we're not here to, you know, talk about it bad anybody, but people make professional decisions. And obviously there's someone in the, you know, Vince has a small circle and there's people in the back who are on Team Stasiak because you're getting these high profile, even though they're ridiculous things with Austin and The Rock. But at the same time, there's someone back there who's definitely not on Sean's on Team Stasiak. Who do you feel had your back, and who do you think was maybe saying, ah, this guy's not good for us?
You know, I don't want to speculate and say names because it would be, I don't know for sure, but probably the ones who are not on the Stasiak team, I would imagine, are the same people that many other people that you've heard talk about would be that person. I wouldn't be surprised, and I wouldn't put it past them. I would rather not even mention names, to be honest with you. I know that in these podcasts you want to look for names. I'm not trying to stir up things, but put it this way. I have fun on Twitter sometimes. I called Cody Rhodes out just, and I'm winking at him at the same time. You know, I'm 48. I'm not a spring chicken, but you know, guys, I got a little something left in me, and for the right business, you know, there's never been a father-son duo to ever hold a WWE title, ever. And I've been kind of promoting this for a few years now. I don't want to say names, but you can only imagine they'd be the same people that are probably, you know, I don't know, maybe it has nothing to do with it, but it just, you get a feel for things, you get intuitions, you get the way that they treat you, the way that the energy, the air you get about somebody. If someone's ever to say to me, you know, that person, man, they were shooting you down, man. They were, you know, really taking it to you, to in Vince's ear, you know, and they said, I'd say, I wouldn't be surprised. You know what I mean? Really. But, and who was on Team Stasiak? I don't know, man. I had, for instance, Dean Malenko was an agent at the time of my release. Fit Finley, those guys were great to me. I think William Regal, when I would seek out maybe some advice or insight from him, he was always, I think if he knew that you really, really cared about your craft and you really wanted to improve, I think he respected that and wanted to be there for you. Arn Anderson was always good, you know. I just don't know. Sergeant Slaughter got me a meeting with Vince backstage, you know, so I think he was on my side. He liked the idea, liked the character that I had in mind. But before they completely shit on it, you know, and made it into a joke. But anyway, I just don't know. It's hard to answer that question, you know, and I'd rather not. I've learned in life not to assume or point fingers unless I know for sure and heard it myself, you know, not to say anything. But you can only imagine, I'm sure, you know, and just put it this way. If you see some tweets from me throwing a jab at him his way, you'll know exactly who I think it might be, because I'm thinking about just, you know, having some fun with this person.
And you say you're 48 years old in great shape. You could still go. When is actually the last time you've wrestled a match? Have you wrestled since WWE?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've had, just some local stuff, you know, here in Texas, a couple little, you know, smaller shows. I've probably done, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 matches since WWE, but you know, I've been away from mainstream TV for, God, since 2002. So it's been, what is that? Almost 16 years. It was, 16 years this month, you know, it's crazy how fast it's gone by. But yeah, I mean, do I recover as quick? I mean, here's the thing with WWE. I'm not interested in going back on a full-time schedule. I'm an older vehicle. I always use analogies. I say, you know, you got to treat look, we can still get some mileage out of this son of a bitch. If you just take care of it and you put the right fuel in and maintain it right, we still got a few nice rides in this thing. We can still, you know, we can go to some destinations here. You just got to be smart about it, you know, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, but you know, to be more of a part-time situation, obviously, or full-time, but use a lot of the time, you know, with promos and cutting promos and interviews and getting people emotionally invested. Because the thing that I learned, guys, is that, you know, art does imitate life. And the one thing that I have now within me is just a lot of hardships, trials and tribulations and tough times that I've had to go through, just like we all have. Right. And I've often wondered, who is Sean Stasiak for real? He's not a poser. He's not that narcissist, stupid gimmick. You know, he's not some clown running to milk trucks and walls. He's not some guy who thinks he's from a different planet. Sean Stasiak is a second generation wrestler. I'm going to say, quote unquote, and wink at you, world-class athlete to this very day, 6'4", 245 pounds, full of piss and vinegar, that is willing to come out of retirement and put his doctor career and speaking career on the side to perhaps fulfill a promise that he made his father, and that is to link the history books as the very first father-son duo to ever hold a WWE title. It's never been done before. And I think that in itself is a story, whether it happened or not, but that would be the objective. That would be the reason of coming back. It would be an inspiring story. And what I've learned about life is I wouldn't be anything more than just me. I don't need a gimmick. You know, Vince McMahon told me that years ago. He says, Sean, you don't need a gimmick. I didn't really understand what he meant by that. I do now, because it's basically taking a piece of, for me, it would be taking a piece of this. I always feel like a survivor. I lost both my parents at an early age. I didn't have any siblings other than a step side of a family, which I do love, but there's been some time and distance. And so there's a disconnect there. And I've grown up kind of feeling alone in the world, you know, in a lot of ways. And so, with that being said, you go through trials and tribulations, and then we all go through our own hardships. But I also feel like a survivor. I feel like a fighter. And I don't want to sound cliche or cheesy, like, you know, taking John Cena's line saying never say never, never give up. But it's kind of my motto. It's like, you know, never do say never. If you have a dream or a vision, go for it, man. And don't be attached to the outcome. Strive for the best. But, you know, it's really the destination that is the blessing. It's the journey, rather. Regardless of what the outcome is, it's just the intent. It's your objective. It's your heart, your soul. It's your passion. And it's a story. And that's what life's about. It's about creating stories. And I've got a real story, guys, with this. There's a lot of real emotion that could be garnered from this exact storyline. My dad really did pass away. I really do miss my father. I'm sure on TV as a Sean Stasiak character today, there would be emotions evoked that no one would, a wide range that you had never seen, because it'd just be real. It's like, and I think that's what makes pro wrestling the most interesting for me anyway, because I know it's a work. I look, we like real. We got, you know, UFC, reality TV, social media, things are real, right? We know that pro wrestling is choreographed, but I love it when there's promos going on or even in a match and thinking, I'd want the fans in the front row to go, I know it's a work, but goddamn, that Stasiak, I think he's pissed off. And maybe I really am, you know? And the promos, blurring the lines a little bit. I love reality parallel intertwined with a work. I think that's what makes it so real. You get elicited real emotions. That's what's good for TV, man. That's what's good for business.
Well, speaking of reality, you have a documentary that you have or you're working on or is out right now?
Oh, that I did that back in 2007, so that's 11 years old, but it's got a lot of good content in it, and a lot of fans have been, I do sell those and getting more copies made, but I'm actually in the works of writing a more updated one, working on that, and yeah, so to speak of the documentary, that was done in 2007, it was called Sean Stasiak Determined. And it's kind of a facet of my life. It shows the different aspects of, you know, just telling stories and going to back to the Portland Sports Arena. That's now a church. Going to the Sportatorium here in Dallas, which is now just a field. You know, they tore that place down. It's just going to different places around the country and just kind of taking along a journey. And I do have a local match. I'm backstage. You know, it's kind of like you're kind of hanging out with me for a few days kind of deal. So it's kind of its own genre. It's a documentary, but I'm working on some film projects and a second documentary, writing for it anyway.
Awesome, man. And then if fans want to follow you on Twitter or Instagram, or promoters want to reach out to you for a booking or anything, is there any emails or your social networks you want to drop?
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting you asked that. Because my social media handles are for Twitter and IG. Instagram is Dr. Sean 008. So it's DrSHAWN008. On Facebook, it's just, you know, Sean Stasiak -Stippish, because everyone knows everyone's real name now. But I just put that on there for wrestling fans, but also for people that I've lost contact with over the years. So that's there. I do have a website. I've got a couple websites. In fact, I got a new one that I'm constructing. In fact, I'm taking my speaking career. I'm really into the Tony Robbins type of stuff, guys. I don't want to claim I'll be the next Tony Robbins, but I sure do aspire to be. I love that kind of work. I love what DDP is doing. I love what Mark Merrill is doing. I love the fact that you guys can get out of the business and do something that has merit and substance and purpose that makes a difference in people's lives. And the Dr. Sean brand that I'm putting, that I've been working on and that's been going, I'm going to refine it now. And so I'm not going to forget about the Sean Stasiak persona. And so SeanStasiak.com is under construction, and it's going to be refined over the next couple of weeks. But I'm going to be offering, I have a lot of people that come to me and ask me for, you know, training advice, nutrition, things of that nature. So I finally decided I'm putting together my own fitness wellness program. It's going to be very, very cost efficient, very affordable. It's going to have a lot of added value in there. So that's coming really soon. But that's just SeanStasiak.com, and I'm going to have those programs there, and they're just to really inspire people to live a more enchanting, vibrant life. I feel it would be a waste of time that I'm 48 and I'm still living this life, the chiropractic lifestyle, and, you know, living a healthier type of life, that it's a shame that if I don't, you know, share the goods and try to help as many people. Not that I haven't already as a chiropractor, but I want to, my real passion, I'm getting kind of out of practice now. I feel like a lion salivating at the bars in a cage. I feel like I was meant to be on stage. And I've always said this, you know, going back to entertain is great. But just to be in an office is liberating, to help change the quality of lives that I have over the years, you know, with my hands, being a chiropractor. But I'm finally putting together the entertainer, the stage guy, and the doctor, and the fitness stuff, and putting it all together. And that's what the Dr. Sean brand's about. It's about inspiring as many people as I can to live a more enchanting, vibrant life, not just physically, but mentally and spiritually. So that's coming soon as well, guys. So there you have it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating story. So one I've always wanted to know, all that stuff about the recording and you know, leaving WWE and going back to WWE. Thank you for your time. It's been a great interview. And make sure to check out Dr. Sean Stasiak on Twitter as a 008 on Twitter, as well as his documentary and everything he's up to. And maybe Dr. Stasiak, you can have that one more run.
You know, well, you know, I don't want to sound cliche, but there's a motto in the WWE, never say never. They brought back guys that, you know, you'd never, I mean, the thing that with me is I never sued anybody. You don't read about me on hard copy.
Right.
You know, I think I've lived a pretty clean life. I'm not perfect, that's for sure. That perfect Sean was a bullshit gimmick, so don't ever believe that I was ever perfect. By a long shot, I'm not. But my point is, man, is I'm open for the right business. And, you know, I think the story, if they were to go to it or go with it, I think that even I think it would draw in out of curiosity. And you got a lot of haters and naysayers and all that, but you got to love them too, right? Bottom line is, it's all, like I said, anything I do in my life, whether I play the Sean Stasiak wrestling character, the alter ego to Dr. Sean, the phobia, charismatic face painted vigilante superhero, if you will, or I'm just, you know, Dr. Sean, or just Sean, anything I do, the most fulfillment and liberation that I get is inspiring people and not bullshitting them. I mean, really connecting with them on the most organic, authentic level and being real. And, I love to make you laugh and put smiles on faces and all that. But at the end of the day, I want you to have goosebumps, and I want to know that I was able to do something, say something, lead by example, that truly made a difference in their lives. That's very important, and that's the legacy that I want to leave. So, guys, I appreciate you having me on, man. I told you I go down rabbit holes. I hope I covered what you needed, but thanks so much for having me on here. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, man, thank you very much.
So what do you think, Robbie? You think Planet Stasiak, Dr. Sean, Phobia has one more run left in him?
You know what? At 48 years old, I saw pictures of that dude. He is still in phenomenal shape. So, I mean, like you said, hey, you think about it and you're kind of like, at first, no way. But number one, he's right. Never say never. And number two, I mean, he's also right that there has never been a world champion, father and son, at separate times, which is actually kind of, the fact that it's already 2018, it's pretty crazy.
You know, many stories in the history of the world started with, man, I can't believe that happened. And it seems along that lines, but at the same time, when you're up against those kind of odds, it makes you more determined. But I thought his story was great. He is a talkative fella, that Dr. Sean Stasiak, is he not?
He is, but the good thing about that is I got to listen to you, Lex, which was better for me.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I just want to thank you for all your insightful questions.
Well, I mean, you know,
I got twins, man. I have a college degree.
You have a college degree. Well, if you want to get your learn on and you want to hear all about our interviews before anyone else does, you can go to wyattended.com/Patreon. Of course, our YouTube channel is wyattended.com. And, you know, we haven't said this one in a while, but we get a lot, most of our listens through iTunes. So when you get our iTunes, if you listen through iTunes, do what I do when I listen to podcasts. Subscribe and leave us a 5-star review.
Also, Instagram and Twitter at WyattEnded. And then, of course, me, Robbie E. Embecht on Twitter. Instagram, Real Robbie E. And then Matt Coon Music if you're into that kind of thing.
And who isn't? Well, I'll tell you what, it was another great show. We're on a roll here with Santino last week and now the great Sean Stasiak on his way back. Anything else you want to tell the fans before we sign off on another great episode of Why It Ended?
No, we will just, we'll see you next week if you decide to come back, and we hope you do.
Wow, what a promo. And we will see you then on Why
It Ended.
Damn it, Robbie.